Welcome to the Lucky Titan Podcast. Here you will learn how to fill your favorite platform with tons of your dream customers from some of the world's top entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Josh Tapp. Now let's get started. What is up, everybody? Josh Tapp here again. Welcome back to the Lucky Titan. And today, guys, we're here with Jeff Morrill, right? And you probably remember his episode from well over a year ago. And Jeff and I had such an awesome conversation. And even honestly, after recording, we had an even better conversation, it felt like. I remember leaving that going, oh, I should just recorded the whole conversation. But I'm excited to have Jeff back here because this guy's done some pretty impressive stuff in his life. I mean, he's done over nine figures. Is that nine? Yes, nine figures with Planet Subaru, one of his companies. This guy's done some amazing different businesses, you know, in real estate, telecom, you know, with Planet Subaru, all these different companies, you know, and really generating just a lot of revenue with these companies, showing what it takes to actually make a company work. And the truth is, I was excited to have him on here to talk about pitfalls and avoiding those pitfalls. And I also want to just throw this in there for everybody too, to make sure you go check out his book, Profit Wise, before we hop into the interview here. So anyways, Jeff, say what's up to everybody and we'll hop in.
All right. Well, thanks for having me back. We had a great conversation last time and looking forward to another one.
Me too. I'm sure it'll be great because I'm genuinely curious about what's been going on. So you've been in a lot of different industries, Jeff, right? And I think you're probably one of the few people in this world who can say these are the pitfalls that happen to pretty much everybody in every industry. And if you were to say across all of those different industries you've been in, what would you say are some of the primary pitfalls or mistakes that people make when they actually try to attempt to scale a business?
Well, if we start with the assumption that it's your team that's doing the work and therefore the people who are coming to work every day for you are critical to the mission of your organization, then your interaction with them is central to the success of your company and in your life, because this is how you're spending your minutes, hours, days, and years with these people. Let's start with this one mistake that I used to make and I'm still working on. And that is that if someone fails in your company in some way, I think traditionally I get upset and I would be, I wasn't going to throw erasers or anything. It wasn't like I was doing that, but I would blame the person for screwing up. And what I've come to realize is that if someone fails in my organization, the first thing I need to do is go look in the mirror and figure out what I didn't do to allow that person to succeed in that moment. So I'll give you an example. It might be that my failure is having the wrong person in the company. I mean, it might be a hiring mistake that we haven't been able to correct with good training and immersing them, that person, in our culture. That could be it. It could be very just simple and profound that the person shouldn't be on the team. But oftentimes we hire pretty well. So that's not it. It might be something more subtle. It might be that we didn't show that person exactly how to do it, or we didn't give them the proper motivation. In other words, we didn't show them how it would benefit them. It would help them in their pay or help the organization by doing it the way we want them to do it. Or maybe we didn't provide them with the right tools. You know, in the case of, we are a blue collar business. So if we don't have the right equipment to change a tire, or the equipment isn't properly maintained, or it's too old, that's not the technician's fault. Whose fault is that? I mean, ultimately, that's my fault. So I would encourage, the next time anyone in your audience gets frustrated with someone on their team screwing up, if they ask the question a little differently after they fume a little bit and get upset, they say, what did I not do to allow this person to succeed? And I think it takes a long time to get to that place in your career where you have the confidence to do that, to say, this is my mistake, even though it wasn't me who dropped the ball.
Right. Well, you know, what's funny is as you bring that up, I think about the first class I took in my MBA program. We talked a lot about this, right? Of establishing cultures and accepting failure in the right places and knowing when to hire fire. And the pervading human behavior with this is to treat everybody like the salesperson, right? Where they say it's always incentivizing them monetarily. And what's interesting is from all the research studies that have been done is it's not always, or monetary is actually one of the lowest forms of incentivizing somebody to do work correctly. It's actually more of like intrinsic things like recognition and what. And I like what you're talking about. I'm curious how you've been able to bridge that gap with non-salespeople, because you've worked with a lot of different salespeople in your, with your different companies. With somebody who's in a non-sales role, how are you incentivizing them to repair the failure without making them feel crushed?
Yeah. Well, even in the case of salespeople, I agree with the principle that you've outlined there. And I see that, people need to earn a living. They've got bills to pay. It's sort of like the cost of entry, though, a competitive salary, some kind of pay plan that rewards them appropriately relative to what someone else would pay them. That's just the minimum. And that's what you get to have their body show up every day. But if you want their heart and their effort and the best of that person, you need to earn that with more than just a paycheck. And so I think it applies to salespeople. It applies to basically everybody in the organization. And I don't have a custom answer for that. What I've discovered is that everybody has his or her own formula. There are some people that what they really need, they need to be told daily how good a job they're doing. They love that affirmation. Maybe I'm reminding myself of that book for marriages called The Five Languages of Love that describes the kind of different things. Maybe you're familiar with it.
Very.
And there's no universal formula. So one of the things for me is I come to work. I mean, when I was an employee back in the day, I used to work for somebody else too, of course. And what was interesting for me is I came to work self-motivated, no motivation required. But if you wanted to extinguish it, you could do that by unwinding my decisions. If you did that to me, you didn't have to motivate me, but I could tell you there was a way to demotivate me. So anyone that was my supervisor had to understand that about me, that they needed to help work with me to make sure that my decisions wouldn't be unwound. So I think it's custom to the salesperson. I think generally you can start with what makes you happy. Do you like when people tell you you're an idiot or that you screwed up? No, I mean, most people don't. You start there. So why would it be a good idea to think that somehow telling somebody that they're an idiot is going to get you where you want to go with them? So I think in the absence of anything else, you start with yourself and then remember that each person's custom. And they're very candid, I think, if you ask people, what do you like about working here? What do you don't like about working here? What keeps you going? What fills your tank? One of our interview questions is actually exactly that. What is the thing about work that gives you energy? And because we want to know early on, is this someone who responds to money, to recognition, to being supported, affirmed, those kinds of things?
Yeah. See, and that's really interesting because I know for myself, money's always fun, right? Even as the owner of the company, if we land a massive deal or something and I can keep a chunk of the money for myself, that's always a good feeling. But there's nothing better for me than hanging out with people like you, right? And being known by more successful people. I love that. It just gives me life because being known by them, but also being friends with them is something that's just fun for me, right? And I get so much life from that. And so it allows me to direct my attention to that. But I know with a lot of employees, they don't even know what motivates them yet. You know, they're like, honestly, they'll be like, oh, money or recognition or whatever. But sometimes it's just that the boss gave them time. Right? You know, having the time to sit down with them. And I'm curious, where you've had so many employees, you know, at this point, how do you instill that in a way that, because you can't always spend an hour with every single employee every single month, right? Because at some point you run out of time. So how do you juggle that when you have so many employees?
Yeah, I think I'm not an expert here. One of the things I do, because we have like at the Subaru dealership, which is the biggest of our businesses and the one that I spend the most time on, we have 85 people. And I used to be there every day. When I say every day, like 7 days a week, and then later six, and then later five, and then I moved away. So I have a managing partner that runs it. I go back several times a year. When I see people, I could spend the week just catching up with people, asking about their kids, and it's just not possible. So I guess what I try to do is set the tone for our managers to do it. And to the extent that I'm there bumping into people, I take every serendipitous opportunity, maybe in the lunchroom or bumping into someone at the water cooler or just walking down the hall, you know, without purposely going to see every one of our 85 people. I can bump into a few every time and hopefully over the course of the year, I'll catch them by accident several times. But it's a big challenge and I don't think I've perfected that sort of connection that you have to people and managing that among all your other time responsibilities, particularly as a company grows.
Yeah. Well, then let's just kind of pivot here really quick. So, that's one of the biggest pitfalls. And I would agree with you is that, learning how to manage the people and learning how to deal with failure. But what are some of those other mistakes that a lot of entrepreneurs make when they kind of dive into entrepreneurship?
Well, let's talk about it. Smaller companies, another one that comes to mind. I work with a lot of people now. I'm on the receiving end of lots of services because I have this large wooded property in Virginia that just needs endless amounts of maintenance. It needs tree work and mowing, and it needs to be plat the driveway. It's a very long driveway. It needs to be plat. I mean, it's just tons, you know, there's leaks that develop in the skylights. It's just one of these things. I'm always hiring people to do things. And I can't tell you how continually frustrated I am by people who cannot keep their word. Yeah. And I'm reminded of a book I read a long time ago by Miguel Ruiz. And the name of the book was The Four Agreements, which is basically his four most important things in life. And one of them was to be impeccable with your word. And what he meant by that is he wanted to make sure that if you said something that you were going to do it, you know, that it was true and accurate. And how often do we interact with people that want to do business with us that we've hired or whatever, and they tell you, I'm going to be there Tuesday, and they're not there. Right. And they tell you, I'll get this piece of information that you need by the end of the day, and they never get it. It's very common. And I think many people underestimate just how much they're sabotaging their business, because not only are they really alienating their customers, but I assume they're doing the same thing to their team members. And team members in this hiring environment, they can work for anybody, probably for more money. Mm-hmm. So if you can't be trusted, they can't count on you. If you tell them you're going to give them a raise by the end of the year and you don't, and then they've got to come asking for it, each one of those things is a withdrawal in that bank account that you have with them, whether it's the team member or the customer. And the way you make investments or deposits in that bank account is by doing what you say you're going to do. And if you're just not very good at doing that, then I've got a secret for you, which is, if you can't keep your promises, then just make fewer of them. If you're the kind of person that has a really hard time showing up on time, then don't tell somebody, I'm going to see you at 3 o'clock today. Right. Tell the person, I'm really busy. I'm going to try to get there this afternoon, but right, I can't promise that I'll be there. So it's the same situation. It's just that you framed it differently. You frame the expectation for the customer, your team members, or whoever that you're working for. So I think that's a very common mistake I see among particularly small business owners and people getting started.
Yeah. Well, I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs feel like they have to make promises to get people all excited to work with them. But the truth is most of the time they're already sold before you start making those promises. And, you know, we'll have people, I've learned this the hard way many times, is that when somebody asks you, can you do something, even if you have the capabilities, it doesn't mean that you should always do that for them, you know? And we've seen many times where I'll be like, yes, we can do that. And I mean it with the best intent possible and being honest about my team has these capacities, but then sometimes it pulls from our core competencies or takes time away from it. And it ends up damaging that relationship because we aren't able to fulfill on what I initially had promised to people. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, totally. And I think sometimes the best thing you can do when working with clients is to say no. And just to be, you know, to say, well, yeah, we could theoretically do that, but but no, this isn't going to work for us. And certainly when you step outside of your systems, mistakes start happening and yeah, things get ugly.
Yeah.
For sure.
Learned that lesson the hard time many times, and I'm doing my best to not ever make that mistake again. Yeah, I love it. So we've talked through failures, right? Making sure that how you manage your failures. And we're talking through right now how to, oh my goodness, spacing this last point, but just what we've been talking about, right? So the truth is like moving forward with business and avoiding these pitfalls. I think part of it is looking at companies like yours and saying, this is how you've been able to scale. You've been able to grow it. And you discussed the importance of team at this point. I feel like that's kind of been the pervading thing with you, is having the right people.
Yeah. So let me jump into another one, which is hiring for experience instead of potential. So this is very much related to team and team building. And obviously, if you're going to scale business and get to the point where we're talking about where all the magic happens, where you're not chained to the business and that you have people, really good people running it for you so that you can, if you're still interested in growing a business, you can go do it yourself, or you have other people who can do that for you. I think the key to bringing really good people on board is making sure that you're not hung up on them having already done what you're asking them to do. That's another way of phrasing that. So a really good example of this, and this happened very recently. One of our service managers, because we have more than one dealership, one of our service managers called me and said, I want to run an ad, and I need counter people in the service department. We call those service advisors or assistant service managers. That's the person who takes the keys and, you know, learns about what your car needs and relays that to the technician.
Yeah.
So anyway, he wanted to run an ad because it was a Jeep dealership. He wanted Jeep specific experience. And the problem with doing that is that if you run an ad that requires Jeep experience in a service department, there are about 3 million people in Eastern Massachusetts. There are probably only a few hundred people that can satisfy that single criterion, or two criteria, I guess, that they worked in a service department and particularly worked in a Jeep dealership. So that's great. It's, I mean, yeah, you'd love to have that person who's just plug and play and knows the product and knows all the warranty procedures and all that, but it's so unrealistic. You've turned your talent pool into what one author called a talent puddle. I mean, it's just drips. You're looking for a unicorn. Right. So much better to run an ad that says, if you want that, you can say, we would love to have experience with Jeep in a automotive experience is great, but not required. We'll train. We're looking for people who enjoy the opportunities in the car business, who like to talk with customers, who find that energizing, you know, all the kinds of things that I talk about in the book about writing a good recruiting ad, but not requiring too much experience. You're looking for the potential, looking for that person who is capable of learning quickly, and then you can mold that person in your image.
And so you're saying instead of hiring off experience, you hire off of potential.
Yes.
Awesome. I thought you were going to say the other way around, because I'm like, oh man, that's the exact opposite of how we hire. Because our big thing is looking at people and saying, we can teach you the skills, right? Nothing that we do is really that difficult. We're not rocket scientists over here. And it makes it easy to hire people because we're like, do you fit culturally? Are you somebody that's really wanting to become something bigger? And when we hire them, it makes our lives easier too, because they don't have their own stigma, I guess, of what it should be or what how things should be, because they don't know.
Bad habits. Yeah, you have to unlearn the bad habits. Yeah, and that's certainly the case for us too. I don't envy medical systems that have to hire doctors,
right?
Or, you know, intensive care nurses, or those things require a lot of experience. But most of us are in businesses that don't. And even jobs that are pretty hard, like to be an automotive technician, automotive technicians do not get nearly enough respect for everything that they know. But they can contribute meaningfully within 3 to 6 months. Now, they're not going to be pulling an engine out of a car in 3 to 6 months, but they can be doing the basic services, and some of the recalls aren't terribly complicated that we do. So they can do those things. And over time, we can grow that person while they're contributing into a master technician. And those are the people who really do the amazing stuff, you know, that they can, you know, the disassemble engines and put them back together without any extra parts left over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be a nightmare. that's why I don't work on cars. My dad is into, he builds hot rods and he loves cars. Mm-hmm. I did not inherit that skill from him. Every time I try to fix it, I'm like, I'm going to be a man and do this myself. I end up taking it apart, cursing 5,000 times, putting it back together and bringing it to somebody else to fix it. So,
yeah. Well, now that I live in Virginia, the businesses are in Boston. So these things that I used to just throw a set of keys to somebody to handle, I've got to do it. Even replacing the washer fluid, kind of scratching my head saying, I'm looking for the cap. You know, it's like, like I said, they don't get enough respect, but there are certainly things that can be learned. And again, it would be a mistake, I think, for companies to underestimate how many skills they can impart in a reasonable amount of time. And the benefit, as you mentioned, you get people to do it your way. If you teach them your way, you don't have to have them unlearn, you know, 5 years of experience or 10 years of them doing the wrong thing or the wrong procedure. Right. And I'm reminded that the U.S. Navy, on its aircraft carriers, will qualify in less than a year.
Wow.
Late teen, early 20-somethings to fire those planes off the carriers or load the very explosive ordnance that goes on under the wings. And these are really hazardous and responsible positions. The Navy can't afford to take 10 years to train somebody how to do that. They will. The pilots train for years before they pin the wings on their shirts. But the people who are firing those planes off the decks, they can qualify those positions in less than a year. So tell me how many positions in most companies are that hazardous and that responsible. If the Navy can do it in a year, you can too.
Yeah. Just look at what they're doing, right? Yeah. And all we do is build content for people. So, I mean, no life's at risk here, but sometimes you're like, man, it's not that hard, right? So we've got to master our systems for sure. Yeah. I love that. Well, so I do want to kind of change directions here for just a minute, Jeff, is I want to know, like, what's next for you? Like, you know, you've done so many different businesses and everything. Like, where's the next big business venture? Or are you like, hey, this is where I'm happy. This is where I'm staying.
Well, I'm blessed that the amount of money that we have coming in is more than the modest lifestyle that my wife and I lead requires. So we've been working on a philanthropy plan and trying to figure out how we can use the abundance that we don't need to serve the world. And I'm really excited about it. It's a little bit anxious for me, though. I'll confess, we started out very modestly. I grew up, you know, with very little. And part of my motivation for being in business was I got tired of just not having anything. And then I gave up basically 25 years of my life to get to where I am and thought about nothing else but money for decades. I'd like a break from that. So I'm really not interested in opening up any more businesses. The business we have do really well. And we don't have, as I said, a very expensive lifestyle. So I'm really interested in figuring out how the money could be used to accomplish good things in the world. So what we're focused on, three areas. We're looking to for animals. My wife and I are both vegetarians. We're animal lovers, not in the way that we think they're delicious, but we're animal lovers. Like, we'd like to see more of them left alone. The second area is the environment and our ecosystem, because we can see that the kind of demands that we are as a species putting on it exceed basically the Earth's long-term ability to support that kind of those demands. And the final thing is people, and particularly supporting people in a way that supports those first two. So to the extent that, like, reproductive choice and health is really appealing in the sense that we love to see mothers bringing children to the world that are really desired and intended, you know, for the people who prefer not to have children at the time in their life, whenever they have children, it would be nice that everyone around the world had access to contraception, for instance. So these are some of the things that we're thinking about, and they're a big change from all the things that I've spent the last, you know, almost 30 years thinking about, but it's exciting.
Yeah. It's so interesting to see when that shift happens. And then, you know, like you said, where the money goes next. It's funny to me to watch how many entrepreneurs, the money is a scoreboard. And then when you get it, it's like, well, don't really need that much, you know, to be happy. More money comes with a lot more problems, it seems like.
It sure does. And one of the surprising things for me was how quickly when I say I didn't think about anything but money for 25 years, I'm only slightly exaggerating. And then whatever, you pay off your home mortgage, and I got a couple of Subarus in the garage, and whatever, we don't really take fancy trips. You get to that point where you're like, well, we're not going to have to worry about retirement or anything like that. And all of a sudden, I just didn't care about money anymore. It was just weird. It was just a strange sensation. I think that feeling maybe arrives differently for different people depending on the circumstance. I don't have any kids. I hear from some business owners that they have this idea that they want to leave this kind of generational wealth, which even if I did have kids, I don't think would be really appealing to me. But in any case, for some people, that's a big thing. So that kind of spurs them to keep building way beyond what their needs would be presently, because they want to take care of future generations. But I don't have that burden. So we're going to find some worthy people to give it to.
Well, I love that. Well, it's awesome to see that you're turning towards helping others. And I love to see that happen more often. Well, Jeff, I appreciate you coming on today and sharing your wisdom with us yet again. I do want to ask you if you could give us one final parting piece of guidance.
You know, this thing that Wendell Berry, he's a poet, and I love his way of seeing the world. And he talked about people who want to change the world without changing the set themselves, and why this is probably not a successful formula. He used that expression, you know, of trying to change the world without changing yourself. And the reason I've been turning it over and over in my head is that usually all the change that people want to see, they want everybody else to do it. You know, if it's political activists, for instance, without, you know, identifying any parties or whatever, they want to see some social change. No one says, you know, brings a placard to a protest that says, here's what I'm going to do to be a better person. so that I cause fewer problems for the community. That's not the thing they bring, right? They want to change. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with activism. I think it's a good way to help change the world. But ultimately, we have to work. We have to figure out who we are and how we're going to improve. And that's probably the most valuable work we can do. So I guess I'd leave with your audience the challenge to find one thing that they could do that would serve the world, that didn't require anybody else to do anything.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Lucky Titan Podcast. If you've learned anything from this or any other episode, make sure you rate it and share it with another entrepreneur it could help. Thanks again, and I'll catch you on the flip side.